For a theory to even claim to be scientific or rational, it has to have scientific evidence to support it. Now, evolutionists believe that they have found scientific evidence to support their theory. If you were to ask an evolutionist, where's the evidence? Where's the proof for Darwinian evolution? You're probably going to hear a discussion of some or all of these alleged proofs of evolution that are on the screen. Biology textbooks are typically, they'll have several pages devoted to discussing these alleged evidences for evolutionary theory. So I want to take time in the next two sessions to wade through these to see if they do, in fact, pass the science test. Ernst Haeckel was a German biologist and an avid supporter of Charles Darwin. He popularized the theory now known as embryonic recapitulation, and he drew charts like this one on the PowerPoint slide. Embryonic recapitulation, called the biogenetic law by Haeckel, not the law of biogenesis, but the biogenetic law. This is the idea that embryos, as they develop in the womb, they repeat the evolutionary history of that particular species. So, for example, according to this theory, humans, as they're developing embryos, they go through stages where they look like the various animals that were supposedly in our evolutionary timeline, so fish and so forth. And supposedly, there's a period of time where human embryos have gills represented in red on the screen, and tails like our supposed evolutionary ancestors. So Haeckel drew pictures of various species in different phases of their embryo development and put them side by side to try to bolster the case for evolution. Embryonic recapitulation still taught in many biology classes today, using the catchphrase, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. The problem is, it was actually shown to be false decades ago. The famous influential paleontologist of Columbia University, George Gaylord Simpson, and his colleague William Beck, they wrote, "The human embryo does not have any differentiated gill tissue, and the gill-like pouches do not have open gill slits as in fishes. Fins are lacking. The tail is not at all like any fish's tail. Indeed, the resemblance to an adult fish is vague and superficial." Bottom line, as Simpson and Beck went on to say, it is now firmly established that ontogeny does not recapitulate phylogeny. So according to prominent evolutionists in the more recent past, Haeckel was wrong. Embryos don't mimic Darwinian evolution as they grow in the womb. Erich Bleckschmidt was a prominent German embryologist and anatomist, the namesake of the Bleckschmidt Collection and Museum at the University of Göttingen, and he didn't pull any punches in his criticism of Haeckel's theory. He said, "The so-called basic law of biogenetics is wrong. No buts or ifs can mitigate this fact. It's not even a tiny bit correct or correct in a different form. It is totally wrong." Well, if that's true, what of Haeckel's diagrams? Bottom line, the material it displays is actually fake. It's a hoax. Misrepresentations, even lies. He not only is known to have altered his illustrations of embryos, he even printed the same plate of an embryo three times and labeled one a human, one a dog, and the third a rabbit in order to show their similarities. Haeckel perpetuated this hoax. Even many evolution-friendly biology textbooks admit as much. Miller and Levine's book, Biology, used widely in the U.S., published in Prentice Hall, says Ernst Haeckel fudged some of his drawings to make the earliest stages of some embryos seem more similar than they actually are. Now, sadly, in spite of admissions like that, biology textbooks still use embryonic recapitulation as proof of evolution. In fact, this statement on the screen is still in the section of the book titled Evidence of Evolution, where they go through and discuss this, and then they throw in that little disclaimer. What about homologous structures? What is that argument about? Evolutionists argue that many vertebrate species have structures that are constructed from the same basic bones and therefore are similar. And because of this similarity, they argue, as does this biology textbook, that homologous structures provide strong evidence that all four-limbed vertebrates have descended with modifications from common ancestors. So similar-looking anatomical structures, according to evolutionists, are strong evidence that we share a common ancestry with whales and frogs. Now, Darwin himself saw homology as a strong point in support of evolution. He said, "We've seen that the members of the same class, independently of their habits of life, resemble each other in the general plan of their organization. Is it not powerfully suggestive of true relationship of inheritance from a common ancestor?" Well, is that true? You know, after all, aren't our similarities to our siblings and our parents proof of our relation to them? Well, first of all, it's important to realize that creationists don't deny that there are similarities between different creatures. We don't deny the evidence. There's no need to. It'll always be in harmony with the true creation model. The problem is not the evidence, it's the interpretation by evolutionists of that evidence. While the evolutionist says that similarities prove a common ancestor, the creationist says they prove a common designer. A common designer. Consider the automobile industry. Many GMC models use the same wheels, the same brake systems and windshield wipers and light bulbs, and even a lot of them even have similar body shapes with one another. Why? Well, because they came to life and mutated into each other. No. Their similarities exist because they were designed by the same company. They share a common designer. And those vehicles were designed to drive on similar roads and freeways and to use the same gas and to use the same mechanics. In the same way, when God designed the lung to be suitable for life on earth, wouldn't you expect, if it's the best design, that you would see a similar design elsewhere if another creature is going to be in the same basic habitat and living contemporaneously on this planet in the same relative environment? In truth, when you examine this closely, the evolutionist homology argument quickly starts to break down and you start to see inconsistencies. For example, humans, we share very similar analogous structures with a lot of creatures. Human structures share similarities with the octopus eye, the pig heart, the Pekingese dog's face, the milk of a donkey, and the pronator quadratus muscle of the Japanese salamander. Evolutionists would hardly deem these creatures our relatives. Even certain plants, the crustacean Daphnia, they have hemoglobin, just like us. Are close relation to us? You related to a plant? Another inconsistency. If similarity proves common ancestry, then shouldn't dissimilarity prove no common ancestry? There's more dissimilarities between humans and other animals than there are similarities. So really the argument only works if you pick and choose. It makes more sense that there's a common designer of these creatures who use certain structural features at several times in many creatures due to the fact that those anatomical structures are ideal for life here. So the homology argument can hardly be used as evidence for evolution when there are such inconsistencies and when structural similarities can be easily interpreted in a more logical way, in a way that doesn't have those inconsistencies and therefore is more in harmony with the evidence. But what about genetic similarities? Haven't scientists discovered that human DNA is like 98 to 99% identical to chimpanzee DNA? You know, on the surface, that sounds like a pretty strong argument for the evolution of man from this ape-like creature and that we're related to him, and it's been touted as evidence for years. But again, when you look deeper and you think about this, you find that that's really pretty misleading. Jonathan Marks is an evolutionary anthropologist and geneticist. He was a professor at Yale for several years as well as UC Berkeley, now a professor at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. And he talks extensively about the dangers of misrepresenting the genetic evidence and reading too much into the DNA similarities between chimps and humans. He has a book called What It Means to Be 98% Chimpanzee. And he discusses this misleading tendency to compare long chains of genetic subunits in DNA. He says, but the comparisons can also be misleading in two important ways. First, such comparisons of DNA sequence ignore qualitative differences, those of kind rather than amount. The second misleading area of DNA sequence comparisons entails a consideration at the other end of the scale. He says, because DNA is a linear array of those four bases, A, G, C, and T, only four possibilities exist at any specific point in a DNA sequence. The laws of chance tell us that two random sequences from species that have no ancestry in common will match at about one in every four sites. Thus, even two unrelated DNA sequences will be 25% identical, not 0% identical. You catch that? In other words, the DNA of a human and any other creature that has DNA will be at least 25% identical, even if there's no claimed relation. So using the same DNA comparisons that are used to compare chimps and humans, a daffodil is genetically 25% human because it has DNA. And according to Marx, its sequence is going to match at least 25% of the time. Does that sound like an accurate comparison to you? Is a daffodil one quarter human, really? What about this comparison? Of the 5,000 best-known human genes, 75% of them share matches with the worm. Is the nematode worm 75% human? Of course not. So this highlights the fact that percentages like that are misleading. They don't really give the evidence that evolutionists are wishing for, and they really only give a little portion of the story. They give this misimpression of significance that simply isn't there. They emphasize what you can't accurately emphasize, and of course, the layman person who isn't a geneticist has no choice but to just take that information and believe it, believing the people that are making these claims because he doesn't have enough knowledge to be able to counter that, not knowing that those kind of comparisons really don't prove anything. Now, as this kind of realization about the genetic code is becoming more widespread and more research is being conducted, some geneticists have started to move away from this whole argument that chimps are 98-99% human and share this common ancestor because of that number. Not only are they recognizing that's misleading, but they're starting to actually realize they were flat out wrong about that. Elizabeth Panisi, writing in Science magazine, admitted, "For almost 30 years, researchers have asserted the DNA of humans and chimps is at least 98.5% identical. Now research reported here last week at the American Society for Human Genetics meeting suggests that the two primate genomes might not be quite as similar after all. A closer look has uncovered nips and tucks of homologous structures of DNA that weren't noticed in previous studies. In 2002, a research study by Caltech presented at the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences proved that human and chimp DNA is actually at least 5% different, and that's expected to continue to grow as DNA is studied more. But still, you know, 4 to 5% different. That's pretty small, isn't it? No! Not when you're talking about genetics and DNA. That's a huge difference. Consider, if we took all of the DNA from every cell and compared the DNA in monkeys and humans, that 4 to 5% difference, that would be 200 million differences between the body of a human and an ape. 4 to 5%, that's not a little thing. When you look at it like that, you know, we're not so similar after all. Evolutionists seem to pick and choose what'll support their theory, and they're not telling the whole story. Consider another factor, DNA, the fundamental blueprint of life. It's squeezed closely into chromosomes, and all cells with a nucleus have a specific number of chromosomes. Now, if humans and chimpanzees were so close genetically and share a common ancestor, wouldn't it be common sense that we would at least expect them to have the same number of chromosomes? Well, that's not the case. Humans have 46, chimps have 48. Well, hey, still, that's pretty close, isn't it? Again, no, not when we're talking about genetics. Differences like that could actually represent significant dissimilarities. A two-chromosome difference in every nucleus and every cell in the body, billions? That's not a small difference. Again, quantitative comparisons don't actually tell us much at all about similarities, and they definitely don't prove a common ancestry. Consider this. The number of chromosomes that living organisms have varies widely, from 2 in the ant to 6 in the mosquito or the nematode worm, 308 in the black mulberry. The complexity of the organism doesn't appear to affect the number of chromosomes the organism has. The Radiolaria is a simple protozoa. It has about 1,600. Humans, which are considered more complex, only have 46. Now, if you were to organize living things based on evolutionary thinking, from simple to complex, you might have an organization like the one on this chart on the screen. Now, if evolution were true, when looking at genetic similarities in chromosomal counts, you might expect that the simplest organism would have the least amount of chromosomes, and it would grow as you increase complexity. And so the most complex would have the most. There'd be a progression, but that's not even close to what you see. The right side of the chart gives the actual progression of chromosomal counts from smallest to largest in order. So according to chromosomal count, man is more similar to the bat than to the dog. I mean, really? Can you really make that comparison? The truth is, genetic similarities or dissimilarities can be very misleading. They simply don't prove what the evolutionists would have you to believe. They don't prove relation or common ancestry. You know, think about this. A strict comparison of chromosome numbers would indicate that humans are more closely related to the Chinese muntjac, a small deer found in Taiwan's mountainous regions. We'd be more similar to them than to a chimp, because the muntjac has 46 chromosomes, just like us. Guess what a chimp would be more closely related to? The tobacco plant. Has 48 chromosomes, just like a chimp. Can you really make that comparison? This doesn't prove common ancestry. Now, that said, would we expect certain genetic similarities in, with various creatures, given that we have similar body structures like with chimps and physiologies and biochemistries and intended diets, and given that certain living organisms were designed for life in similar environments, similar habitats, ultimately given the same designer? Humans and chimps are both mammals and both have similar types of internal organs. We both eat fruits and vegetables, which means our mouths and digestive systems have some similar characteristics. We both have eyes, ears, noses, mouth, fingers. We get sensory information from those structures. So there's no doubt there's going to be a lot of similarity between humans and chimp DNA, but you can't jump from A to Z and say, okay, that means that we evolved from some kind of ape. Similarities exist and would be predicted and expected if we share a common designer. But once again, while that's in harmony with what we would say in the creation model, if a person contends the genetic similarities prove we evolved from this common ancestor, then you start seeing these inconsistencies. The evolutionary model is not in harmony with the evidence. It's not reasonable and scientific. It's closed-minded. It's biased. It starts with this baseless assumption, a rejection of all non-natural possibilities for the origin of the universe. Holding to that assumption without evidence, rather than allowing the scientific evidence to lead you to the truth, whatever the most reasonable answer may be, whether or not you can stomach it, that's the issue. What about horse evolution? Hasn't that been documented in the fossil record? It's definitely been taught as such in biology textbooks for decades. Supposedly, the modern horse known as equus has been documented as evolving from the small fox-like creature known as Hyracotherium or Eohippus. One popular biology textbook used in Texas high schools in the 90s said, in spite of the missing pieces, paleontologists can offer a relatively clear picture of the evolution of many organisms. One example is the series of fossils that shows the development of the modern horse over 50 million years. The authors then proceeded to show the standard horse evolution diagram showing the alleged evolution of the modern horse from Hyracotherium, claiming the first horse was actually quite small, about the size of a small dog. This illustration shows the first horse as well as several of the intermediate ancestors of today's horse. The 2006 edition didn't rectify the problem. On page 439, the authors used the standard classic pictures of horse evolution to illustrate the nature of evolution by gradualism. John Rennie, writing in the prominent science magazine Scientific American, 2002, he said, actually, paleontologists know of many detailed examples of fossils intermediate in form between various taxonomic groups. A sequence of fossils spans the evolution of modern horses from the tiny Eohippus. So evolutionists will tout horse evolution charts as decisive evidence of evolution. The problem is the evolutionists themselves, the ones in the know, long ago abandoned horse evolution as an example of transitional forms. They're realizing that the evidence for a gradual evolution, evolutionary progression in the fossil record simply isn't there. And so they've actually decided they need another theory. And they're trying to now move away from this idea of a gradual, straightforward progression. And they're thinking, well, maybe it's more of like this bush with varying branches, as though that really is going to fix the problem. David Raup of the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago admitted 30 years ago, well, we're now about 120 years after Darwin, and the knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. Ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. By this, I mean that some of the classic cases of Darwinian change in the fossil record, such as the evolution of the horse in North America, have had to be discarded or modified as a result of more detailed information. What appeared to be a nice, simple progression when relatively few data were available now appears to be much more complex and much less gradualistic. In other words, there's no evidence of these current transitional creatures linking various kinds in the fossil record. That evidence is needed in order for evolutionary theory to be possible, but it's simply not there. The famous paleontologist of Harvard, George Gaylord Simpson, way back in 1953, summed the truth of this issue up when he said, the uniform continuous transformation of Hyracotherium into equus, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never happened in nature. So some evolutionists will then say, well, that doesn't matter anyway. What about whale evolution? We've proven that. We got whale evolution, and so we don't even care about horse evolution. One Science Daily article titled, Whales Descended from Tiny Deer-like Creatures, said, whale evolution is one of the best documented examples of mammal evolution. Here it is. This is the mecca of evolution, I guess. I don't know. One of the best documented examples of Darwinian evolution. If you wanted proof of evolution, here's a place you'd go. Let's see how well documented that is. Supposedly, in this well-documented story, whales evolved from mammals that lived on land and that supposedly gradually moved into the water in search of food, fish, and other water prey. Now, in a 2007 edition of Nature magazine, J.J. M. Thewissen, who's an evolutionary anatomist and professor at Northeast Ohio Medical University, he claimed to have found the oldest and closest relative of the whale. Now, here's the problem. For many years in this supposedly well-documented evolution of whales, guess who the closest whale relative was? The hippopotamus. Okay, now, if that's the case, there's no way that whale evolution is well documented as they claim, because Thewissen claims the whole evolutionary community needs to totally change their entire theory about this. Supposedly now, Indohyus, who's a small, stocky artiodactyl roughly the size of a raccoon, should now be considered the closest relative of the whale, a creature that looks like the African mouse deer. I look like a whale to you? Now, okay. If whale evolution has been so well documented, as they claim, how can you make a major switch like that at the drop of a hat, as though that's no big deal? You're changing from a hippo to a small, stocky artiodactyl, roughly the size of a raccoon, really? Now, surely they can't be quite as confident in their theories as they proclaim to the masses if you can make a change like that. Now, in this supposedly well-documented evolutionary story, whales evolved from land-living mammals. They gradually moved into the water in search of food. Now, again, Thewissen totally turns this upside down. Now, according to Thewissen, the mammals that gradually moved into the water in search of prey apparently weren't even carnivores like they always thought. Clearly, this is not the case. Indohyus is a plant eater and already is aquatic. Apparently, the dietary shift to hunting animals, as modern whales do, came later than the habitat shift to the water. So with the discovery of one deer-like fossil, the whole alleged evolution of whales is now swept aside. Whales didn't evolve from land-living ancestors in search of food. Their ancestors were supposedly already in the water and were herbivores, not carnivores. You think that's significant? It's abundantly clear to me, wait, this is not very well documented as they're claiming. Now, what in the world do you suppose links the Indohyus to the whale? What's so significant about the find that made Thewissen want to change the evolutionary lineage of the whale? According to scientists, although Indohyus, as it is known, looks nothing like the whales of today, yeah, it shares certain anatomical features. You think that there's anything else that shares anatomical features with the whale better than this deer, really? That's kind of vague. Doesn't the whale share anatomical features with others? What makes the Indohyus so special? Exactly. Thewissen actually admits that these anatomical features are, in fact, shared with other creatures. He says, all of these characters are found in some mammals unrelated to cetaceans, so whales. Okay, so what's so special about the Indohyus? The distinguishing feature of the Indohyus appears to be his teeth, which are suggested to be very similar to the whale's teeth. So it's homology. It's a homology argument. What we would say is, even if they are similar, it just means a common designer. The entire evolutionary shift, though, is being based on something that vague. Now, here's the problem with that idea. Indohyus is a confessed herbivore, and the teeth of whales are carnivores. Now, they ridicule us if we argue, based on Genesis 1, in Genesis 9, that there is some indication that originally all creatures were herbivores, not even carnivores. They ridicule us about that because the teeth of these two different types of creatures. Bill Nye scoffed at Kim Ham in the Nye Ham debate over that very issue. And now they want to argue that the teeth of the herbivore Indohyus is somehow similar enough to the carnivorous teeth of whales, and that's the reason for this shift. What do you get out of that? Well, one thing I get is that we can gather from that is that they seem to be a bit desperate. That's what I get out of that. Apparently, the evolutionary timeline of whales can be flipped upside down at the drop of a hat. Apparently, their beloved theory isn't as well documented as they claim. Evolutionists appear to be frantic and rash in their clamor to find evidence, to try to keep this theory alive. And of course, there's other motivations too, prestige and so forth. What about vestigial organs? If evolution were true and human beings are the current dominating species in this long line of evolutionary changes, starting with this ape-like creature, not only would you expect the fossil record to reflect that, but you would expect at least two other things as well. Number one, there should be humans alive today in these transitional stages, right? That's logical. In other words, you should be able to examine the human population and find human beings in the process of evolving into better, supposedly more fit creatures, you know, growing wings or a fifth chamber in the heart or something. And wasn't that the premise of that old comic book series, X-Men? Do we see evidence of that actually happening? Do we see humans transitioning into growing wings or being able to walk through walls or gaining super healing immune systems where you can put knives in their hands and stuff? No. In fact, as the Earth deteriorates in harmony with the second law of thermodynamics, don't we see the exact opposite happening? More and more has to be done just to keep us alive due to the mutations and disease and so forth, the genetic conditions which are arising that cause harmful syndromes in babies. Now, secondly, if evolution were true, we should find vestiges in our bodies, leftovers from our evolutionary ancestors, organs that our ancestors had and used, but which we no longer need, but still have left over in our bodies and genetic code that just haven't been dumped out yet. And evolutionists have historically admitted that such vestiges should be present, and so they call them vestigial organs, vestiges of our evolutionary ancestry. In 1895, German anatomist Robert Weidersheim claimed to have found 86 human vestigial organs. Evolutionists, of course, were elated, promoted the idea that vestigial organs prove evolutionary theory, but one by one, guess what's happened? They're getting marked off that list. Let's look at a few of the often cited examples very quickly. The appendix, small pouch that hangs off the end of the large intestines. For several years, scientists didn't know what it was for, so they thought it was a vestigial organ. One widely used textbook in its 2006 edition, a biology textbook, said, in humans, the appendix is an example of a vestigial organ because it carries out no function in digestion. As usual, the textbook writers either failed to get the memo or they ignored it, because now scientists know that the appendix is an important element of the immune system, especially in children. Lymphoid tissue resides within the appendix, which produces white blood cells that fight disease and infection, especially when you're young. The appendix is relatively larger in children than it is in adults. Also, recent research indicates that the appendix is involved in replenishing the good, beneficial bacteria after certain illnesses eliminate bacteria from the intestines. So bacteria which help to keep the bad bacteria in check. So the appendix cannot be considered a vestigial organ. The tonsils, once again, were thought by scientists to be vestigial, pointless, useless, a vestige of past evolutionary progression. Scientists now know that tonsils actually help us in fighting off germs. The coccyx, another so-called vestigial organ, evolutionists believe it's an undeveloped tail and use it as proof that humans evolved from a monkey-like creature, since they believe it serves no other purpose. We now know the coccyx is an important organ in human anatomy. It's the point of attachment for several pelvic muscles that help us to stand up. Also serves as a shock absorber when we sit down. Without it, we wouldn't be able to sit very well or comfortably. Hair. Evolutionists also thought, many still think, hair is a vestige of evolution, thinking it serves no function. We, of course, know that's simply not true. Seems like that would be obvious to me. It's a crucial element of human anatomy. It protects the skin from skin cancer, especially on the head, but it also helps us to stay warm. It's a thermal barrier. I actually talked about that at the lectureship, I think, last year. It also serves as a warning system, an alarm system, a tripwire that warns us if something potentially dangerous is crawling on us. It is far from being a vestigial organ. The wisdom teeth have long been considered vestigial organs, the idea being that our supposed ape-like ancestors had bigger jaws. So according to evolutionists, extra teeth were needed at that time. Now we supposedly don't need those. And there's just not enough space in the jaw for them anymore, so they tend to become impacted. They ram into other teeth. Well, there's several problems with that idea. I'll mention just one. Scientists have discovered that the dental crowding that causes the impaction of the wisdom teeth is significantly affected by a society's diet. Lombardi, writing in the American Journal of Orthopedics, said, "Dental crowding is endemic among technologically advanced populations and uncommon in primitive groups. In modern man, there is little attrition of the teeth because of a soft, processed diet. This can result in dental crowding and impaction of the third molars." So Western diets cause dental crowding and the impaction of the third molars, or wisdom teeth, not evolution from some kind of ape-like creature. Wisdom teeth cannot be said to be vestigial. What about junk DNA? This alleged evidence is taking center stage in many circles today. Jerry Coyne is an evolutionary geneticist of the University of Chicago. He explained it this way. When a trait is no longer used or becomes reduced, the genes that make it don't instantly disappear from the genome. Evolution stops their action by inactivating them, not snipping them out of the DNA. From this, we can make a prediction. We expect to find in the genomes of many species silenced or dead genes, genes that once were useful but are no longer intact or expressed. In other words, there should be vestigial genes. He and many others believe they have found exactly that in the human genome, vestigial genes, or as others call them, pseudogenes, junk DNA, DNA that perhaps our evolutionary ancestors used but which we no longer need. But as with vestigial organs, guess what? Scientists, as they further examine the human genome and figure out more about what's going on, they're discovering maybe they're a little too rash in their claims. And sadly, as the evidence pours in proving they were wrong, it's too late to undo the damage that's been caused by their false claims. Jonathan Wells is a molecular and cell biologist of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute in Seattle. In his book, The Myth of Junk DNA, he cites several prominent evolutionists who used the junk DNA argument. He says the arguments by Dawkins, you recognize that name, Dawkins, Miller, Shermer, Collins, Kitcher, Koine, and Avice rest on the premise that most non-protein coding DNA is junk without any significant biological function. Yet a virtual flood of recent evidence shows that they are mistaken. Much of the DNA they claim to be junk actually performs important functions in living cells. The following chapters cite hundreds of scientific articles that testify to those functions, and those articles are only a small sample of a large and growing body of literature on the subject. This was in 2011, and he goes on and cites hundreds of articles, not by creationists, but just geneticists that are figuring out, oh, okay, this isn't junk DNA. We thought it was junk DNA. We were wrong. So the evidence against junk DNA is growing by leaps and bounds, as was the case with vestigial organs. The more we actually learn and aren't so arrogant to think we have the answer so fast, the more we discover the fact that the universe has been intricately designed with specific purposes in mind, as you would expect from a chief engineer. All right, so in truth, there's no such thing as a vestige from evolution, because as we've been saying, evolution is not only not in harmony with the evidence, it actually contradicts it. So we would already mark this whole idea off anyway. The alleged evidence that is said to be conclusively proving of Darwinian evolution is shown to be non-existent the more scientists learn about the universe. In fact, even if there were such a thing as an organ within the human body that appears to no longer be necessary for humans today, it still wouldn't prove evolution. Because the creationists could contend that the existence of those kind of organs would likely indicate something about the nature of the earth in the distant past as God originally created it. You think the world that then was, that perished, is anything like what we see today after a global flood? The pre-flood era, that was different. In other words, if there were such things as useless organs in humans, it wouldn't be because we evolved from some kind of non-human creature. It's because humans once needed those organs, especially perhaps in an environment before the flood. But ultimately, after scientific knowledge has increased and evolutionists have discovered time and again, each of these organs on Wiedersheim's list serves a significant purpose in helping human beings. Many evolutionists are correctly losing faith in the vestigial organ argument. Today, many evolutionists have all but abandoned the idea, and thankfully so, because a strong argument could be made that evolution is a hindrance to scientific progress because of its reliance upon alleged vestigial organs. Think about this. What do you think would have happened in the scientific community when Wiedersheim produced that list? The effect would have been to halt the scientific study and investigation of those organs, or at least significantly decrease the amount of research being conducted on those areas. Since according to evolution, we don't even need those anymore anyway. How many people do you think have been affected by evolutionist promotion of this argument over the years? Now, vestigial organs are a myth. We know there's an important function for these organs, even if we don't know enough yet to figure all of it out. Once again, the textbooks will still promote this idea. Young people are being duped into believing that this is solid evidence of evolution. But don't miss the major implication of just this brief look. If evolution is true, there should be vestigial organs. They shouldn't be so hard to find. They should be there. It's as if the human body came into existence exactly as it is today with only minor changes over time. Oh, wait. I think I know a model that fits. You know, in the end, the vestigial organ argument has done nothing but actually provide more evidence that the creation model is the rational choice. It's the scientific choice. What about the fossil record? This is that chart I told you I found. Such a brazen statement like that. Doesn't the fossil record indicate that humans evolved from this ape-like ancestor? That's what they boldly claim. It's been confirmed. It's been established. We win. Is that true? Let's look at the actual evidence and answer that question. You know, I've got a lot of material on this that I'm not even able to cover in this session, but let's wade through some of this. First of all, what would we expect to see in the fossil record if evolution were true? Now, if the literal account of creation in Genesis 1 is true, we can make predictions, okay? Scientific predictions. Evolutionists claim we can't make predictions as though the creation model isn't scientific. That's hogwash. We make predictions all the time. We make a prediction that in the fossil record there should be a notable absence of transitional forms, since God created creatures according to their kind. In other words, there shouldn't be creatures in the fossil record or still living that are half pig, half zebra. You know, some kind of mythological creature or something. And there shouldn't be creatures that are half ape, half human. Instead, if the creation model is true, the fossil record should show fully functional, distinct types of living creatures when they first appear in the fossil record. If evolution is true, if there has been this gradual transformation of kinds of life throughout history over millions of years, then there should be evidence of those gradual changes in the fossil record. There should be a large number, billions, of these transitional forms, linking all creatures, but even just humans, with this alleged ape-like creature. There should be billions of them in the fossil record. And there should be creatures like that still in existence today. Evolutionists realize and admit that the fossil record should reveal transitional forms. The problem is the evidence isn't there. Darwin himself realized that in The Origin of Species. He said, the number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed must be truly enormous. Geology surely does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and serious objection which can be argued against this theory. Yeah? What theory is he talking about? He's talking about the one that he's proposing, right? Darwinian evolution. He recognized this is a pretty good argument against my theory. The fossil record doesn't support it. The explanation lies, I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record. Okay, so he, of course, hoped. We give it some more time, let people study the fossil record a little bit longer, and it's going to eliminate this concern. Been 150 years. It still hadn't helped the case. Here's Kate Wong, evolutionist and senior science writer for Scientific American. She said in 2012, the origin of our genus Homo is based on meager evidence. There's a notable gap in the fossil record. Evolutionary paleontologist from Harvard, Stephen Jay Gould, who I've quoted oftentimes before already in this seminar, the absence of fossil evidence for intermediary stages between major transitions in organic design, indeed our inability, even in our imagination, to construct functional intermediates in many cases, has been a persistent and nagging problem for gradualistic accounts of evolution. It's a nagging problem. It should be there. It's not. You think this guy knows what he's talking about, Stephen Jay Gould? One of the most famous of paleontologists from Harvard. He also said, all paleontologists know that the fossil record contains precious little in the way of intermediate forms. Transitions between major groups are characteristically abrupt. I wonder which model that one supports. That's exactly what we would predict. Characteristic, you got this kind of creature, and all of a sudden, boom, another kind. It's abrupt. There's no transitional gradual. It's a characteristically abrupt. In other words, it's a different kind. It's exactly what we would predict. And this guy is admitting it. He went on to say, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. What does he mean by that? Well, he means you're not going to learn about that in any kind of schools or the media or anything. It's a trade secret. Guess where you have to go to read it? Natural History, an evolutionary journal. And who in the world wants to read that unless you happen to be a creationist that has to do this all day? Or an evolutionist that actually believes this hogwash? So it's a trade secret. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable. Not the evidence of the fossil. So, okay, so he says, okay, you imagine this evolutionary tree, all right? You got this creature down here, this supposed common ancestor, and then it branches out to all these other kinds of creatures. And guess where he says you've got actual species? Up here, the tips and the node. You've got no transitional creatures in there. So in other words, you've got completely distinct creatures when they show up. He says the rest is just inference. In other words, it's just speculation. You know, what is he inferring from? From the assumption of evolution. So whenever you've got this creature here and you've got this creature here and you say, okay, well, this, I think, you know, we look kind of like that. It's found a little bit deeper in the ground. We got this and this. Well, let's draw some things that kind of, let's infer, because we know evolution happened. So let's infer what it would have looked like. Inference. Not evidence. Not the evidence of the fossils. It's not there. What you have are fully distinct forms when they show up in the fossil record. That's what you got. That supports us, not them. David B. Kitts, late evolutionary geologist, paleontologist, professor of geology and the history of science at Oklahoma University. He said, despite the bright promise that paleontology provides a means of seeing evolution, it's presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them. If evolution were true, the fossil record should abound with this. It shouldn't be so hard to find them. For some reason, they're not there. So seemingly in a panic, evolutionists find a few bones here and there, and they're really rash and quick. We found the missing links. Here they are. All right, you give it a little bit of time, guess what happens? The secret they don't announce too loudly is they really hardly found anything that they even try to claim helps them out. Mariette DeChristina is the editor-in-chief of Scientific American. She said recently in 2012, pieces of our ancient forebears generally are hard to come by. However, scientists working to interpret our evolution often have had to make do with studying a fossil toe bone here, a jaw there. That's what they have to work with. That's most of the time, that's what they got. Toes, you think that's enough to make any actual conception of what an organism looked like? Richard Lewontin, research professor at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard, considered to be one of their most brilliant evolutionary biologists, according to their website. He said, the main problem is the poor fossil record. Despite a handful of hominid fossils stretching back 4 million years or so, we can't be sure that any of them are on the main ancestral line to us. Many of them could have been evolutionary side branches. This was in a presentation he did in 2008 at the AAS meeting. So they're just coming out and admitting it. They don't have much. In fact, according to him, they can't even say that any one of them could be used as an actual, legitimate transitional form conclusively. They may not even have anything to do with us at all. Writing in Science Digest, Lyle Watson, who's a well-known evolutionary biologist and zoologist, he said, the fossils that decorate our family tree are so scarce that there are still more scientists than specimens. The remarkable fact is that all the physical evidence we have for human evolution can still be placed with room to spare inside a single coffin. I think that's kind of ironic myself when I read that. Because if you don't have transitional creatures, that means death for evolution. That's what that means. Because they should be there. They're not there. I want to take some time and look at what's in the coffin of evolution. As Watson, DeChristina, and the others said, the fossils that have been found and used to try to show the evolution of man are scarce. Usually just a skull may be found, or a thigh bone, or a toe, or a jawbone. If paleontologists are lucky, they may find a fossilized skeleton that's like 40% complete. And from that kind of evidence, they will guess and speculate and infer and conjecture to no end to try to prove that the bone that they found proves evolution. Now, Lee Berger is the paleoanthropologist of the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. He's been in the news a lot recently over finding the Australopithecus sediba fossils. Now, writing in Scientific American, he chided the standard practice in paleontology of trying to draw too much information from these single isolated bones. Now, the sediba skeletons were more complete than typical fossil finds, even though the sediba skeletons were nowhere near to even being 50% complete. But he makes the point that if any of the bones that he had found had been found isolated, which is the typical scenario in fossil finds, completely different conclusions would have been drawn about the skeleton anatomy. Here's what he said. Sediba shows that one can no longer assign isolated bones to a genus. Well, about time. That's what we've been trying to say for decades. Bernard Wood is a paleoanthropologist and professor of George Washington University, as well as adjunct senior scientist at the National Museum of Natural History. He said Berger's absolutely right that isolated bones don't predict what the rest of the animal looks like. Now, you think it's likely that many people are going to listen to Wood and Berger? No way, because the vast majority of the fossil finds that allegedly prove human evolution are based on isolated bones. Let's look at a few of them. The bones that lie in the coffin. Now, this list on the screen is the standard evidence that's given by evolutionists for the evolution of man. This is going to be most of the Latin words and so forth, or the media-given words that you'll probably hear. Evolutionary scenario has no chance of succeeding without the existence of legitimate transitional fossils. If evolution predicts gradual transitional changes over eons of time between these kinds of animals, the fossil record should have evidence of that. So as these ape or human-like fossils have surfaced, then they tend to be rash and desperate, not necessarily always dishonest, but reckless in their claims. The media spreads it far and wide. And guess, whenever they find that they were wrong, the retractions are pretty small. You don't hear about the retractions, but they're there. Again, you got to dig. You got to be willing to do the time to dig and find them. Science textbooks, of course, will miss the memo altogether or ignore it and continue to publish the erroneous supposed proofs for years to come. Let's go ahead and go through some of these. Neanderthal man, very famous missing link fossils. Supposed to be a missing link in the chain between ape-like creatures and humans, but after examining the fossil remains of the famous skeleton, Dr. A.J.E. Cave proved that Neanderthal man was nothing more than an old man who suffered from arthritis. Dr. Cave noted that every Neanderthal child's skull that had been examined at that point apparently was affected with severe rickets. In children, it's common for rickets to produce a large head due to the late closure of the epiphysis and fontanelles. As Eric Trinkaus, evolutionary anthropologist of Washington University in St. Louis, one of the world's foremost authorities on Neanderthals, he said, detailed comparisons of Neanderthal skeletal remains with those of modern humans have shown that there is nothing in Neanderthal anatomy that conclusively indicates locomotor, manipulative, intellectual, or linguistic abilities inferior to those of modern humans. So Neanderthal's anatomy is indistinguishable from modern human anatomy. And on top of that, modern human fossil remains have been found near the remains of Neanderthals that have been dated as older than the alleged dates of the Neanderthals. You see a problem there? Modern humans came from them and we dated earlier. And then there's this recent research by this team working on sequencing the Neanderthal genome. And they've sequenced the genome. Guess what they found? The leader of the team, Ed Green, assistant professor of biomolecular engineering at UC Santa Cruz, he said this concerning Neanderthal DNA. Two chimpanzees are roughly as different in DNA sequence as a human and a Neanderthal. Now think about that. When you look at the genome of two chimps, admittedly chimps, their DNA is going to be slightly different, right? He said it's the same thing between modern humans and Neanderthals. In other words, they're modern humans. That's what they are. You find them a little deeper. But guess what? Creationists would interpret that different. Not evolution. We would interpret that different. We believe the strata form quickly in, I don't know, a massive global event of some sort. Back in 1891, evolutionists found fossilized teeth, the upper part of a skull, and a thigh bone on the banks of the Solo River in the Dutch Indies, and assumed they were from this transitional creature. From these few bones, evolutionists presumptuously drew what they thought this creature would have looked like, calling it Java Man. You think you can really come up with that from that? No, but that doesn't stop these wild claims by these paleo artists. You know, paleo artists have been very influential with what they've done over the years with their artistry. Over time, scientists found out the leg bone and the teeth were actually from a modern human. The skull cap was from a monkey. A few years after this find, while Java Man was still famous, in 1926, Professor Eiberlein of the Dutch Medical Service found what appeared to be a complete skull in the same area that Java Man had been discovered, and seemingly like the alleged Java Man skull. And again, the fossil was hailed as more evidence of the transitional creature, and I had to dig, but I found the retraction. The next year, 1927, The Smithsonian Institute said that the skull was actually the kneecap of an elephant. Little retraction. Nobody would have probably noticed it. Who reads the retractions anyway, right? No transitional creature. In 1912, a doctor found a jawbone, a portion of a skull, in a gravel pit in England, assumed that the fossils were from this transitional creature they call Piltdown Man. And from those two items, evolutionists made a skull to show what they thought this transitional creature's head would have looked like. In 1953, it took a few decades, Piltdown Man was found to not only be not what they thought it was actually fake, it was a fraud. The skull fossil had been found to be from a modern human, the jawbone was from an ape, and the fossilized teeth had been changed on purpose. They had been filed down by evolutionists and treated chemically to make them look old. Again, they admit this openly. Definitely no transitional fossil here. And again, I definitely wouldn't want to leave the impression that all evolutionists are somehow dishonest. I wouldn't say that. But once more time passed by, they end up discovering, oh, we were a little too rash about that, and the evidence disappears. But guess what? It doesn't matter, because we already found this one over here, that there hasn't been enough time to study yet. Right? That's the trend, over and over and over. That's what I'm finding in my reading. 1922, newspapers printed a picture of male and female human-like creatures that evolutionists had drawn based on one tooth. This is the different angles of one tooth, and that's what they came up with. You think you can do that? Really? Isn't that amazing? Wow, I just didn't know you could do that based on one tooth. Something I'm curious about. If I ripped out a tooth and you tried to draw a picture of me from that, I'm really curious what you'd come up with. Writing in Science magazine, Michael Balter discusses his interview with anthropologist Adrian Zillman of the University of California, Santa Cruz, who highlighted eye-opening practices of those evolutionists that are working to sort out human evolution. Here's what it says. In her view, much of the work that human evolution researchers do today is based on conjecture as well as hard science. The paleoartists, Zillman told Science, are doing what the rest of us do. Most of what we do is part art and part science. Now, I mean, that's a nice way of putting it. Again, these paleoartists are extremely influential in shaping the public mind. Again, remember, pictures speak a thousand words. They're powerful, especially with kids, but they affect all of us. It's been influential in making people think evolution is a fact. But notice they admit that a part, I'd say a large part, is based on conjecture, and only part science. The other part being art, they call it. That's a nice way to put it. Well, the creature they came up with here was they called Nebraska Man, also called Hesperopithecus. But guess what? Within 5 years, scientists had decided the tooth was actually from a wild pig, not a transitional creature. Thank you, paleoartists. Another example of the dangers caused by paleoartists taking liberties, Hobbit Man. 2004, 10 years ago, paleontologists digging on a small Indonesian island in Flores discovered a few bones from 7 different individuals that hadn't yet completely fossilized. And the most complete individual discovered, labeled LB1, which consisted of most of the skull as well as some of the leg, hands, feet, and pelvis bones, it was thought to be a species of its own and given the Latin name Homo floresiensis. And it's already in some of the textbooks. The media called it Hobbit Man because he was thought to be only 3.5 feet tall. Now, Michael Liminick, writing in Time magazine, he said, "What makes the discovery truly shocking is that the beings were not, like the pygmies of equatorial Africa, just a short variety of modern Homo sapiens. Dubbed Homo floresiensis, they represent an entirely new twig on the human family tree. The chapter of biology textbooks that describes our family tree will have to be rewritten," he said. And they were. Again, I see this creature in a lot of the evolutionary charts, but guess what? August 6th, that's this month, isn't it? Scientists announced, whoops. The Huffington Post began their announcement of the latest studies with the line, "Were scientists all wrong about prehistoric hobbits?" Though they thought they had a new species on their hands with Homo floresiensis, 2 new studies indicate that the skull that affected their interpretation was merely from a human with Down syndrome. Isn't that kind of like rude? Really? When measurements were taken of the thigh bones, the skull circumference, the cranial volume, and compared to previous figures, The bones were found to fall in the typical range of modern humans that have Down syndrome. Imagine what that would feel like as a Down syndrome person. Professor of developmental genetics and evolution at Penn State and one of the authors of one of the studies, Robert Eckhart, he said, the difference is significant and the revised figure falls in the range predicted for a modern human with Down syndrome from the same geographic region. Apparently Hobbit man, just a modern man. The remains of Rhodesian man were found in a zinc mine in 1921 and displayed in the British Museum of Natural History for years, but the fossilized hips had been crushed, which caused the displayers at the time to portray the creature as stooped over. Once again, years later, when actual anatomists, others had examined the fossils, Rhodesian man was actually found to be merely a modern human being. July of 1866, Josiah Whitney, the head of California's Geological Survey, unveiled his discovery of a skull that had been found in Calaveras County, presenting a paper to the California Academy of Natural Sciences. It was discovered in a mine shaft beneath volcanic deposits that were believed to be a million years old. So it'd make it the oldest known human-like being on the continent. But it looked very much like the skull of a Native American, they noticed. So William Holmes, a Smithsonian archaeologist, wrote, quote, to suppose that man could have remained unchanged physically, to suppose that he could have remained unchanged mentally, socially, industrially, and aesthetically for a million years, roughly speaking, is to suppose a miracle. So a million years, and he still looked pretty Native American. So either the skull is extremely old, a million years old, and proof that evolution didn't happen over a million years, thus disproving evolution, since it's so similar to modern humans, or it's actually young and therefore not even a candidate for an ancient evolutionary ancestor, which is what they claimed. Well, Calaveras man is ultimately irrelevant now since it was determined to actually be a hoax, supposedly planted by local miners in the mine for Whitney to find. They didn't like Whitney, and so they planted this mine to make him look silly. Not good for evolutionists. Now, keep in mind that many evolutionists themselves admit these blunders and hoaxes. I'm not just trying to pull one over on you. Here's how famous skeptic Michael Shermer put it. He said, hoaxes like Piltdown Man and honest mistakes like Nebraska Man, Calaveras Man, Hesperopithecus are in time exposed. In fact, it wasn't creationists who exposed those errors. It was scientists who did so. That burns me. Let me tell you. Notice, first of all, he erroneously implies creationists aren't scientists. Did you catch that? It wasn't creationists, but scientists who found these mistakes. That's garbage. What he means is it was evolutionists who exposed the errors. Now, that said, notice that he admits that these blunders and hoaxes aren't just creationists making up stories. Evolutionists themselves are admitting that their alleged evidence is hailed far and wide as conclusive proof of evolution, oftentimes end up being wrong, even by their own words, after it's studied more. Calaveras man, not proof of evolution. Carbon dating in 1992 indicated that the skull was only about 1,000 years old. And guess what? There's still some that try to hold on to Calaveras man as proof of evolution. Heidelberg man, named Homo heidelbergensis, was based off of a single lower jawbone pictured on the left on the screen compared to a regular modern-day human jawbone. Heidelberg man was recognized by the guy that found him, Daniel Hartman, to look very human-like. And so he knew he belonged in the genus Homo, but notice it's pretty big. Apparently too big for Hartman to consider Homo sapiens. According to Donald Johansson, who's the American paleoanthropologist who discovered the famous Lucy fossil, Hartman decided to give him a special name and put him in a species of his own in spite of its strong similarity to the human jawbone. Now, Mr. Hartman, just because it's bigger doesn't mean it's not human. Wouldn't we have a prediction of what that actually could be? Wouldn't you like to see Goliath's jawbone beside a modern human? Or even Andre the Giant? That wasn't that long ago. That may be exactly what we're seeing here. Flipper Man. In 1979, what appeared to be a collarbone was found at a site named Sahabi in Libya, and some scientists believed it belonged to this primitive ape man. After further investigation, the collarbone was found to be the fossilized rib of a sea mammal that was similar to a dolphin. Are you noticing how hard it is for them to find transitional fossils? You'd think if transitional creatures ever existed, it wouldn't be so hard to find the remains, since there should be billions of them. Billions, people, billions. It shouldn't be that hard. Then in the early 1980s, a portion of a skull, just a skull cap, was found near the Spanish village of Orsay. Again, evolutionists quick to announce this fragment was from an ancient human-like child. And from that small fragment in green, they constructed an entire human they called Orsay Man. Later, the bone was conceded as likely being the skull cap of a six-month-old donkey. Handyman, Homo habilis, is a creature that Lucy supposedly evolved into, a three-foot-tall ape. And once again, evolutionists will construct these models and paintings without enough evidence, and they grandiosely speculate and conjecture. And a fairly complete fossil skeleton of Handyman was discovered that indicated that this creature was simply an ape and in no way related to humans. The skeleton of Handyman is just as primitive as Lucy, which is supposedly 2 million years older than Handyman. If evolution were true, then 2 million years worth of time, we should expect to see some significant progress in evolving towards man. But Lucy's just as primitive as Handyman. No missing link here either. What about the elusive Peking man? 1920s and 1930s, a few fossils were discovered near Beijing, China. Evolutionists were quick to call the fossils transitional creatures, proof of evolution. They dated the fossils from between 300,000 and 800,000 years ago using evolutionary dating techniques, but scientists have found conflicting evidence from the same site. In 1933, several fossils of modern humans were also discovered who weren't supposed to be on the scene yet. Bottom line, evolutionists will never know for sure. Because within a few years, in 1941, the fossils disappeared. They went missing. Gao Xing, a paleontologist and member of the working committee, yes, there's a working committee, to find these skulls. It's called the Working Committee to Search for the Lost Skull Caps of Peking Man. And he said, quote, "We don't know where the bones are. They may well have been destroyed, but we have to look." Yeah. It's ironic to me, the more that evolution is examined, the more its alleged evidence goes mysteriously missing. Cro-Magnon man, what's all the talk about this fellow? Is he proof of evolution? Evolutionists claim that Cro-Magnons were the first creatures with a skeleton that they admit looked completely modern anatomically, hands down. Recent genetic research by a team of European geneticists from the universities of Ferrara and Florence showed that a Cro-Magnon who lived in southern Italy, they say, 28,000 years ago, was a modern European genetically as well now, they recognize. Okay, so if it looked like us anatomically and was like us genetically, what's the difference? If it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, in this case, if it bleeds like a duck, it's a duck, okay? No missing link here either. Cro-Magnon man is just a modern man. Again, found a little bit deeper in the earth, that's all. But notice this pattern. Quick claims that the evidence has been found. Time passes, some more time, some further study and investigation. Retractions have to be made. Takes forever for those to get out to people. But over and over again, you'd think more people would see the pattern and accept the truth. There's no evidence for this evolution thing. Sadly, many people will believe what they want to believe regardless of the evidence. We've gone through half of these on the screen. We've got material on our website that goes through the rest. And again, I've got lots of material that I present in lectures on this. You like that? It took me a long time to make that. Anyway, so check out our website if you want to wade through the rest of those Latin names. Bottom line is they have no conclusive evidence in the fossil record. So, you know, that whole statement, we have the fossils, we win. Not so much. You don't have the fossils, so I guess that means... Hey, I didn't say it. You said it. All right, this chart again states the fundamental planks of evolutionary theory and the opposing stance that the creation model takes. All right, so if any one of these planks is untrue, the entire model collapses, and we've seen from the laws of thermodynamics, the universe couldn't have created itself. That by itself disproves all of naturalism right there. We know that the universe therefore could not have spontaneously generated or be eternal. We also saw from the law of cause and effect and the laws of probability, those stand in the way of spontaneous generation of matter and life as well. Once again, the creation model has no problem with that evidence. The law of biogenesis and the rules of genetic mutation prove that spontaneous generation, macroevolution, and neo-Darwinism are unscientific and irrational in light of the scientific evidence. And once again, both of these areas of science support creation. And now we're seeing that the alleged evidences in support of evolutionary theory, when examined a little closer, prove to, in fact, not be in support of the supposed evolution of man from this common ape-like ancestor, and in support of macroevolution. Embryonic growth, similar physical structures, genetic similarities, vestigial organs and genes, horse and whale evolution, the fossil record, none of these alleged evidences of human evolution can reasonably be used as evidence for macroevolution. These are legitimate issues, people, that stand in the way of naturalistic evolution. Problems that demand an explanation. Question, where's the evidence for naturalistic evolution? It's not there. If so, why are we even talking about it? Why has creation been thrown out when it harmonizes with the evidence? Without a reasonable, rational answer to the problems at the feet of evolutionary theories, supernaturalism is still the clear choice in keeping with the evidence. In the last sciencey session tomorrow morning during our Bible class hour, we'll look at these last two items, uniformitarianism and the idea of the earth being old. So we'll be looking at the dating techniques, which allegedly prove the universe to be old. So make sure that you're here for that. And then we'll finish up in during the worship hour with responding to the question that I get asked a lot at my seminars, usually after that first session. People say, wow, you know, that's a lot of evidence against naturalism. Why in the world are there so many people that choose to be atheists? And the Bible answers that. We'll talk about that. Now, I did want to remind you again, if you haven't had a chance, be sure to take a look at the material we have back there in the back. Make sure we're arming ourselves to be ready to give a defense, earnestly contending for the faith. AP's been around for over 30 years, trying to help Christians to be able to do just that, especially in the new areas in which Satan is throwing darts. And we try to put materials out as close to cost as possible, understanding that we need to keep producing these materials and new materials, because the point of AP isn't to make money. Thankfully, we are supported by many congregations like this one to try to be able to do that, so that you can have people like me that just full-time get to study this stuff, and so that you don't have to go dig in and do that yourself. But I did want to tell you a little bit more about some of our adult products real quick. Our monthly Christian Evidences Journal, Reason and Revelation, has been around for a long time. We've given it a facelift a couple years ago, try to make it more attractive for coffee tables. The content has changed slightly too. We have shorter articles in there now. We try to have more variety to make it a little bit easier on readers. Make sure if you don't subscribe to that, you look into that as a great way to stay abreast of the latest in the apologetics community. We have lots of books, including this one, Behold the Lamb of God, looking at how can you know that Jesus even lived historically, and looking at what the Bible teaches about the deity of Christ. This one on the inspiration of the Bible. trying to think if I'm... There was a guy at a seminar I did in Russellville, Arkansas. It's typical for... I don't know that any are here today, I don't know, but it's typical for biology professors, for some reason, to show up from the local universities and chew on me a little bit in my seminars. And at this particular one, a couple biology professors came up to chew on me. And a typical response people are giving today to the idea of the existence of God. And this, I believe this is a relatively new thing, because 50 years ago, when evolution was really taken off in our country and being put in the school system, if you could refute naturalism and evolution, most people in this country understood which God exists. It's the God of the Bible. But now you've had pluralism for 50 years being shoved down people's throat. So now people are asking, the same way this biology professor is, you know, okay, so you've proven there's a God, but you haven't proven it's the God of the Bible. How do you know which God exists? It could be the spaghetti monster. And I always say that. Spaghetti, I don't know where they... The spaghetti monster. Or it could be Allah or Buddha. How do you know it's the God of the Bible? Well, you know, I answered the guy, as hopefully any one of us can, with a simple phrase. We have evidence for which God, because the Bible contains characteristics which prove it to be beyond human capability. And he... Nobody had told him that. He sat there actually flummoxed. He was like, really? He gave me this look. He goes, I'd like to see some of that. And I go, well, I've got some material back here. Come on. And one of the elders stepped forward and bought that book for him. That's the point of that book, to show the qualities of the Bible that prove it to be beyond human capability. He said, I don't want to buy it. I don't want to support you guys, but I would like to see that book. So he took it. I don't know what happened after that, but I actually would be curious. These two books respond to the typical alleged contradictions that are levied against the Bible. A lot of times, if you're talking to an atheist or a skeptic type, they'll rattle off a list of 10 or 15 alleged contradictions that prove that the Bible is not from God, it was written by humans, because, hey, if the Bible has an error in it, that is a problem. These two volumes respond to those. We actually have enough probably material for a third one if we, if Eric will have the time to put it out and we can raise the support for it. Truth About Human Origins is actually the book that has a lot of the more fossil evidences. It's pretty heavy science-type book, but it is popular and sold by a lot of organizations, even outside of AP. It gets pretty deep into evolutionary things. This one here, Christian's Guide to Refuting Modern Atheism, is as a result of Kyle Butt's debate with Dan Barker. A lot of things were brought up by Dan Barker that he didn't have time to address, and so a book came out of that. And it really responds to the latest arguments that the atheists are making against the Christian movement. You know, God's a, you know, he's genocide, sexist, homophobic. You know, he advocates killing children by sending the Israelites in to kill even all these babies. You know, what did they do? So all of the latest attacks being made on the God of the Bible, dealt with masterfully, of course, by Kyle and Nat. Surveying the Evidence, this is our flagship book on Christian evidences, giving you a brief survey of Christian evidences, existence of God, inspiration of the Bible, creation, evolution, deity of Christ, and so forth. This one may be my favorite book here, and that's in spite of the fact that that's my book. But but I don't know, you know, it's my book, so I like this one. I'm not saying you should buy this one because you need this material, but I like this one because it really gets into this dinosaur question. I think refutes it. It shows the evidence that humans and dinosaurs coexisted, which would be predicted based on the creation model, and it's just fun to read that. Some are unaware of the fact that AP has materials on all kinds of things that are not just creation evolution, and not even just specifically Christian evidences and the inspiration of the Bible, for example. We try to stay current in the battles in the apologetics realm. Things being fought in society that Christians need to be prepared to give a defense of, whether it's, you know, medical ethics and genetic engineering, homosexuality and abortion, environmentalism. This, of course, my dad's book on how you can know the Quran is not inspired, the issue of illegal immigration. My dad's series on, of course, you know, the attack that's going on the founders and on America, trying to, the separation of church and state, that kind of stuff. Make sure you're aware of those as well. Also, we have some materials that are more directed towards Christendom at large, doctrinal type issues, what the Bible says about, and then we've got a series on that. This one on principle of authority in the Bible, and of course the instrumental music issue in response to Richland Hills out there in Texas that began using the instrument. I don't even know how many years it's been now. Has it been 5 years yet? Something like that. Responding to that, and my dad, I think, did a masterful job of dealing with that. Addresses really about any argument that I've ever heard on the issue. And then a very succinct booklet on what the Bible says about how to receive God's gift of salvation. So if you would, make sure that you take a look at the booth, make sure you have what you need in your apologetics ministries and your individual lives especially. Thank you for your attention, and we'll see you tomorrow morning. David, are you going to? Okay.